Welcome to Going Deep, Sports in the 21st Century on Blue Ridge Public Radio. I'm Dr. Marcia Mount Shoup.
And I'm Coach John Shoup.
John's coached at the highest levels of the game of football for 26 years.
And Marcia is an author, theologian, and minister.
And we're glad you've joined us to go deep into some of the most pressing issues of our time.
On Going Deep, we go beyond the sound bites and highlight reels.
Hi, I'm Matt Bush, the news director for Blue Ridge Public Radio, and I help the Shoups produce Going Deep. In this episode, we discuss an exceptionally stressful time of year for football coaches. December isn't just about preparing for bowl games or recruiting. If you've had a bad season, you may be getting fired. A good one, and you may be getting a job at a bigger school. At the very least, you're likely a part of the coaching rumor mill that goes into overdrive in December. It's commonly called the coaching carousel, but our hosts start this episode by telling us it's a different amusement park ride that the experience is most like.
So for us, it's always been more like the coaching roller coaster. I think carousel, you know, suggests kind of this easy, mundane, you know, think kind of predictable thing. But for coaches and coaches' families, it really is. It's an emotional roller coaster. It's stressful whether you're on a winning team or a losing team or a middle of the road team. I mean, there really is no such thing as a year when you're not somehow impacted. I mean, even us out of it now can feel it and are impacted by it in different ways. So for us, roller coaster fits much better than carousel.
It's a roller coaster indeed. Even when you have good seasons. When you have good seasons, you've got this tug and this pull or this lure towards other jobs that you might be considered for that are going to offer you more money, maybe a better situation, and you're weighing all those situations of, okay, would I move my family for that? Or the situation of, if you're an assistant, is your head coach going to take another job? You know, a really good friend of mine was a head coach at Colorado State, Jim McElwain, and got promoted, if that's the word you want to use, to being the head coach at the University of Florida. And when he went to Florida, none of the assistants from Colorado State went with him. And so all of those guys were out of a job. And so the roller coaster is not just for teams that are worried about, son of a gun, we didn't have a great season, are they going to fire us? The roller coaster is also like, son of a gun, we had a pretty good season. Is our head coach going to leave for another job? And or am I going to have to consider another job?
Right.
You know, it was really not funny. I mean, interesting to me. I now teach high school at A.C. Reynolds High School, or teach history at A.C. Reynolds High School. And we lost our third-round playoff game last week to Mount Tabor. And I was driving home from the game with my daughter, who's a freshman in high school. And she said to me the entire game, Dad, I was just cringing. I had this feeling of, oh, my gosh, are we going to have to move now? We're losing a football game. Are we going to have to move? And I stopped the car, and I said, we could go 0-10 here at A.C. Reynolds High School, and we're not moving. We're not moving. And so I think when people talk about this coaching carousel, they talk about these coaches leaving, moving all over the place, there's a lot of collateral damage. There's a lot of issues that people don't consider, and that's just a situation that punched me in the gut the other day.
Yeah, and I think too, like the coaching, you know, that term carousel also, it makes it almost playful. And this is what people are gossiping about and what people are talking about. If anybody thinks that old women are the worst gossips in the world, they have never been around football coaches at this time of year. I can tell you that,
absolute,
I mean,
worst.
Starting at the end of October-ish, when stuff starts to be fomenting, John would be getting phone call after phone call, and I'd hear him in the other room going, hey, have you heard anything? No, have you heard anything? I mean, and it's just like frantic texting and all this stuff. And again, you can be in a good situation, a bad situation, no situation. I mean, even this year, John's gotten phone calls and stuff. And it's just, it is like old ladies gossiping, you know, whispering in the back room to see if anybody's got any scoop on anything. I have tried to I've taken off all those feeds on my Twitter feed, like football scoop and all that stuff, because just it is, it's like this visceral memory of, I'm going to have to take my kids out of school. I'm going to have to find a new job. We're going to have to sell our house or whatever. Or some of our friends are going to have to leave. You know, neighbors asking you every day if you've heard anything. It's stressful for everybody. The other people that people often don't think about at this time of year is players. Players are deeply impacted by this whole thing. It's not a game for them either. It's their life. It's the school they decided to go to. There are very few players who decide to go to a school just because of that school. They go because a coach recruited them, because they wanted to work with that coach, because that coach made them promises.
And I think for people, listeners of the show, if they heard those particular shows that you did with Pat and Robinette, they will know that. If they haven't, I certainly suggest they go back and listen to that, because you went into that with him, with Pat and Robinette, about his time at Vanderbilt. He played mm-hmm. for James Franklin, who was now the head coach at Penn State, and that was at the time where Coach Franklin left Vanderbilt to go to Penn State. And you heard it in his voice when he was discussing, like, it's very stressful. We didn't begrudge him being able to leave, but that was why he went to go play. One of the reasons he went to go play at Vanderbilt.
Right, and then they can't leave. They can't leave so easily. I mean, they have a whole different set of rules, and they have a whole different set of limitations. The other piece that people don't often think about, and there's some really good examples of some of these situations that we could talk about more deeply, is what hits the news is a head coach and his big buyout and his, you know, six more years he had on his contract or something. But for assistant coaches, more and more, even just in the 26 years that John coached, assistant coaches' contracts were getting shorter and shorter and shorter, with less and less guaranteed money, less and less cushion. And some people might listen to that and say, well, too bad, I don't have a contract. I don't get paid if I get fired. Well, you're also probably not in a profession that demands this kind of like instant relocation. Maybe you're not working 18 hours a day, 7 days a week. I mean, there are lots of demands about this job that sometimes you do need a little cushion, because you might have to sit out a year depending on the timing of the firing. But head coaches get these big buyouts and assistant coaches don't. They also don't have the same kind of mobility as a head coach. They're sort of waiting to see if, you know, where a head coach they might have a connection to lands. And they might not land anywhere. It's like a game of musical chairs. Mm-hmm. And the later you are in the roller coaster season, the less likely you are to land anywhere, really. Would you say that's correct?
Well, certainly it's exactly like a game of musical chairs. And when the music or the hiring stops, you want to be left with a spot. It's interesting, in the coaching profession, there's a couple of times where I never dreamt we would go live in that place. And I'm thinking of Oakland specifically. When I went to work for the Oakland Raiders, we were interviewing at a few different places and had some options, and I never dreamt we would live in the Bay Area. It never even crossed my mind. But as the music was starting to settle, that ended up being the place that we're like, holy moly, we're actually moving to Oakland now. We're moving our entire family across the entire country, four time zones to Oakland. And we ended up loving living out there for a spell in many ways. Mm-hmm. And so there is an adventuresome, you know, part of it. But as your kids grow older, it gets really, really hard. I can remember after my first year in West Lafayette at Purdue, I thought to myself, we're going to struggle here. I didn't have real fond feelings for our head coach. And I thought, even after our first year, before our first year, I thought professionally, this might not have been the best move I could make. I don't think our head coach can get it done. And therefore, you know, I'll be susceptible. And I had a chance to leave to go to an SEC school after our first year at Purdue. And we had just built a house. We had a farm. Our kids just got settled into school.
And they were happy.
And they were happy. And I just recruited a quarterback who's the star quarterback for Purdue right now. And I thought to myself, I was offered a heck of a lot more money at a SEC school. And I thought to myself, I need to try to make this work here for my family, for the young men who I recruited. And I could see the writing on the wall that this was going to be an uphill battle. And I think that's uncommon. I think we see coaches just jump around so much looking for this perfect job instead of trying to make the job where they are a really good one. Mm-hmm. And frankly, the situation at Purdue, I failed to make that job a really good one. I don't know that it was any fault of my own. I think I did everything that I could, but that lure, that lure to move, that lure of money, of bigger jobs, it's seductive. And
well, it's not just seductive. I mean, I hear what you're saying, but I understand why people do what they do. I understand why people jump ship. There isn't a lot of loyalty. There's no guarantees. And I mean, families just kind of like resign themselves. Like, this is our life. We're moving a lot. And I think you're right. It's rare for people to make a decision to stay. And the hard truth of that is it doesn't pay off. It rarely pays off to make that kind of choice. And we made it several times, and I think we feel good about those decisions in terms of our moral conscience and the way our values hit the ground in our life. But those probably weren't good professional decisions.
at North Carolina, we didn't take a head coaching job to stay, and the next year our head coach got fired. Mm-hmm. I can remember speaking with Jay Smith, and Jay Smith is a professor at the University of North Carolina and a guy that's had a loud voice against some of the NCAA and the academic fraud that's gone on at North Carolina. And when I talked to Jay, I said, I would trade a six-figure, seven-figure salary in a heartbeat for an opportunity to gain tenure, which you have, Jay. And I've thought of that a lot, you know, on college campuses, that some of these professors have tenure. I'd rather have tenure and make a modest salary than a huge salary in every single year, wonder, are we going to have to move?
Yeah. You're always
good or bad season.
You're always a provisional member of the community, and you know that.
So you brought up a lot about the power dynamics within this, and we're going to start first with head coaches versus assistant coaches, and the one big power dynamic there, not just how everything is set up, it is the buyouts. And everyone now can talk about the buyouts head coaches get if they're fired. Larry Fedora at the University of North Carolina, that was a $12 million buyout. Bobby Petrino at Louisville, $13 to $14 million buyout. even on a lesser scale, at the University of Maryland, we did shows about this. DJ Durkins was over $5 million and was one reason why the university at first apparently wanted to keep him and then backtracked a few days later. So talk about the buyouts and this power dynamic it creates, because that is an incentive to keep a head coach. But as you were saying, assistant coaches are on one-year deals. And boy, if there's a downturn in the season, we hear all the time, the assistant coach, the coordinator,
somebody's going to take the fall.
Is the one who has to walk the plank and take the sacrifice.
Not all assistant coaches are on one-year deals. And in fact, a funny thing is, if you look at a state university, for instance, at North Carolina, I can remember our head coach, Butch Davis, called me in one day and said, I'm giving this guy the title of associate offensive coordinator, this guy the title of associate head coach. This guy, he was giving out titles to people because the university said if the person has a title, they're allowed to have a two-year contract. And so he was just making up titles.
The vanity titles, that seemed really silly, right?
Yeah.
But it's another year on your contract.
I mean, you take it then.
He literally said to me, John, I'm giving these guys titles. They mean absolutely nothing, but it's a way I can get them a two-year contract. So if you look through kind of a media guide or you know, the website of college coaches at state universities, some of their titles are just bizarre, and you wonder, what's that? And sometimes that method is to get them maybe a longer contract.
Well, just another year.
Another year. And so that's been beneficial for people that have titles. Having said that, some of these coaching staffs, you're allowed 10 assistant coaches, but they have support staffs of 30 to 50 people, some of these programs.
Alabama.
Yeah.
And those people are wiped out. And those people have nothing. We've had to change jobs where we were at the end of a contract, and we've changed jobs where we had time still on our contract. And so there's certainly that for assistant coaches. But for a head coach to leave a job and be paid $12 million, rest assured there's not an assistant that has that same sense of security, and those assistants are the ones that really work their tail off for that head coach. And there's certainly times, I've had a great deal of resentment, like, that head coach just got paid $10 million to get fired. And that's the least hardest working human being I've ever been around in my life. This is just white collar crime, I felt like.
Inevitably, you see people being like, well, the university's paying all this money to fire somebody, and, you know, faculty doesn't get this money, or whoever doesn't get this money. I want you to stop and think about it for a minute. If a university is willing to basically flush $12 million down the toilet, how much money does that mean they're getting through this business venture called collegiate revenue sports? Okay, that needs, instead of shifting right into the script of that's not fair for faculty, for think about
The players
who don't, not only do they not get a dime when everything's going well, they don't get a dime when everything goes down the tubes, and they can't transfer without penalty. They can't pick up the pieces. I mean, even though we, you know, didn't have huge buyouts when, in the unfortunate times when we were, you know, forced to make a decision to make a change, we're going to be okay. We had saved money. We had an opportunity to accumulate both social capital and financial capital in the business. Players don't have that. And so if you want to go into the pity party of it's not fair for the, you know, English professor in the school, think about the commodities of the players that are generating this money, and watch a coach, get $12 million for getting fired, and they don't know if they're going to have a meal card anymore because they don't know if the coach is going to come in, the new coach will come in and maybe not want to use that. So there's a lot of insecurity that just ripples out from all this, and that the kind of buyout frenzy is kind of a red herring. It's a very isolated boon. It doesn't trickle down. Have you ever heard, John, maybe I'm just naive, but have you ever heard of a head coach, when he gets fired and gets a big buyout, giving some of his assistants a cut of that money? I've always wondered about that.
I know Conan O'Brien did it when he left the Tonight Show, but he wasn't a football coach.
That's never happened to us. But have you ever heard of that happening?
No. I've never heard of that happening. And I can remember thinking when I guess it was our fourth year in the NFL. We were just young, newly married, no kids. In our fourth year with the Carolina Panthers, they fired our head coach, Dom Capers, the year after he just signed an eight-year contract. So 1 year into an eight-year contract, they fired Dom Capers. I really don't know who's making these decisions. I mean, it's bad business. But anyhow, I can remember thinking after that year, that means I'm going to have to find a new job. And I did a great job, I thought. Our quarterback, a guy named Steve Berline, played at an incredibly high level that year. And I thought I did a really, really good job. And it was that first time, and I like Dom Capers and have deep respect for Dom Capers, but I thought to myself, I can remember thinking, you need to give me some of that money. I can remember thinking that, and it's never happened. And I think of that all the time. Larry Fedora's walking away with $12 million, and he's going to be fine. I know coaches on that staff, friends of mine that are on that staff right now, that are scrambling.
Yeah,
and
don't know what's next.
And they worked their tail off for him for the last 7 years.
The other piece that I think is out there that makes this time of year really, like, just almost this kind of devastating reiteration of, like, wow, the human race is kind of messed up. And that is the people who get head coaching jobs. Now, let's use the Liberty University situation as an example.
And we will get into more on that on a different episode of Going Deep, because once this hiring came to light, I remember going like, wow, that is about 100 different things John and Marcia could probably touch on. But
yeah, but
we'll
let's just talk on a very superficial level about that. Hugh Freeze is a man who lost his job at Ole Miss because he was using, I mean, I don't care if he was using his own money to hire an escort service, but he was using like the school's credit card and his phone.
School phone to make calls.
To make his calls to escort, you know, an escort service. He's the same age as us, 49 years old, has a family. He also presided over a time in which Ole Miss was sanctioned for lack of institutional control at Ole Miss because of, blatant cheating that they did there. So here's this guy. He's out on the job market. He's been out for a year. He left an SEC job under shameful circumstances. There's no other way to say that. And he was just hired by a university that is a Christian university, and one of the reasons they hired him is because he's a, quote, good family man. And there are just so many parts of that that are hard to take when you are people that have been in the trenches doing the work, being an honest person, being somebody who tries to do the right thing, tries to be honest with people, makes sacrifices to make sure other people have what they need, and then he gets another head coaching job. That is hard to process, and there is a lot more to talk about there in terms of this kind of rhetoric around sinfulness and forgiveness. And I know Hugh Freeze said Jesus, you know, is the one that can, you know, handle all my junk or whatever. And yes, that, okay, that's a nice, you know, concept of grace. But it also begs the question of what are the character traits that are valued for this business? And really when it comes down to it is, will you do whatever it takes, even if it's cheating, even if it's lying, even if it's, you know, really not having a moral conscience, will you do whatever it takes to win? And unfortunately, sometimes those are the people that succeed in this business because they'll do whatever it takes. And I hate to say that, but it is, you know, it has been for the 26 years we were in it, a very withering part of this time of year, a gut-wrenching part of this time of year. To, you know, I'm kind of getting choked up a little bit. Just, you know, watching good people, not just my husband. I, of course, I think he's awesome. He's my husband, and he is an awesome human being. But other people that we know, fine human beings, really people so dedicated and loyal and so generous, get passed over for, you know, people who don't seem to really care who they hurt and the way they use their power. Sorry. Just got on a little soapbox.
Well, to just put a cherry on top of all of that, this roller coaster happens right at the holiday season. Mm-hmm. And that just compounds it infinitely, really. And it is. It's hard. It's hard when you see people that you know are unethical, getting other jobs and being paid a lot of money. That's hard to see. But it also pains me to see that those are the men that are going to be coaching these players.
Young men, yeah.
Those are going to be the models for these young men. And so it's kind of self-perpetuating, you know. And it makes it sad, not just a head coach, but I see assistant coaches. There's assistant coaches that are, it's just known, they'll cross the line. They'll break rules. They'll do whatever and to get recruits. And when you see them hired and when you see them paid just enormous contracts, it does it. Part of you is like, this is not what the game of football needs right now. The game of football needs men who, needs leaders who are more ethical.
Have a social or moral conscience, maybe?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe they don't, though. That's what I've come to wonder about. Maybe that's not what football needs.
So looking at the other power dynamic that we mentioned in this, outside of head coaches and buyouts, is transfers.
Mm-hmm.
And this obviously comes up too. Now, coaches leave really without penalty if they get a new job. Players don't have the same. We're going to use one coach in particular here as an example, and that is Scott Frost, who's now the head coach of the University of Nebraska, has finished his first year there. Last year, he was head coach at Central Florida. They went undefeated and claimed the national championship, even though they did not play for it. But when he left and took the job at Nebraska, he played at Nebraska as a player. He took 7 assistant coaches along with him from Central Florida. They mm-hmm. go there. This year, there were some players from Nebraska looking to transfer. 3 of them looked at potentially transferring to Oregon State. Oregon State is where the prior Nebraska head coach, Mike Riley, is now an analyst, and several of his assistants that were with him in Nebraska are now at Oregon State, too. Scott Frost, as a head coach in Nebraska, blocked those players from being able to transfer to that school.
Mm-hmm. We've Your seen thoughts. That happen before.
I think that's a small and unethical decision. I think to block any student's transfer is small and unethical. let me say this. I completely understand the strategy of you have a good player, you don't want to let him go. Mm-hmm. I can completely understand, especially not letting someone go to someone who's an arch rival.
In your conference, right.
Yeah. Not that Oregon State is an arch rival of Nebraska. But I can understand that. That doesn't mean I agree with it or I would ever do it. I have always thought that if a player wants to transfer, they should be allowed to transfer. Even when I was coaching, I believe that. I have had conversations with players and said, you need to be careful about this decision. I don't think this is a good decision. I think this is a better place for you. But I want to be very clear. I, as a coach, have helped young men who have come to me and said, I want to transfer. I've called coaches. I've set up visits for them. I tried to help them find a good spot. And I was brutally honest with them as well, saying, I don't think you're as good as that player. I think you're going to sit on the bench. I think you're transferring looking for a better situation when this one is here. But that's your decision, and that's your decision with your family. I think it's very small for a guy who, for any football coach or basketball coach to not allow a player to transfer. It's small. And I looked at it this way. When you're going to transfer, we'll get your scholarship back, and I got to recruit my tail off to get a player, you know, better. And usually if a player wants to transfer, it's because they're not in your top 22 players anyhow. So rarely do you see a mm-hmm. superstar player who wants to transfer. Although Kyler Murray, the superstar quarterback and the AP Player of the Year for Oklahoma, did transfer. He transferred from Texas A&M to Oklahoma because he thought that was a better situation for him. And you know what? It was. And recently, we saw at the University of Alabama where a quarterback, Jalen Hurts, was the SEC Player of the Year as a freshman and then lost his job to another freshman quarterback while Jalen was a sophomore, and he decided not to transfer. Well, after deciding not to transfer, Tua, the quarterback in front of him, got injured, and Jalen came in, and it was a really, really feel-good story. And people have used that story to prop up. Do you see the lessons of sticking to it, of not transferring, of not changing schools? And while I certainly admire Jalen's stick-to-itiveness, his toughness, and I was rooting for him in the SEC championship game like every other football fan probably was, I certainly don't admonish or think less of people who do leave for what they think is a better situation. Because I got news for you. Nick Saban left Michigan State right in the middle of the bowl season to go to LSU because he thought it was a better situation. He left LSU to go to the Miami Dolphins, and he left the Miami Dolphins after telling everybody, there's no way I'm going to leave, to go to Alabama. And so he's been one of the people that says, I can't believe these young men want to transfer. It strikes me as really quite hypocritical because he himself has continually, throughout his career, left situations to find better ones.
So, John's exactly right. He's painting a very vivid picture. It's not hard to see that. I mean, you can see it all over a place. There are so many examples of this dynamic. And so what I want to say to our listeners here is, if you continue to have questions about the abusive nature of the way power is used in college revenue sports, just look at the transfer rule. There is no other reason other than control and power that players need to be treated this way. They're shamed for trying to find a good situation for themselves. They're shamed for trying to advocate for themselves. I don't know, some of our listeners may have seen the video on Facebook a few weeks ago of a basketball coach in one of these Christian schools down in, was it Georgia?
Florida,
who a student said he wanted to transfer. And the guy just, I mean, just, it's not even belittling. Belittling is not an adequate term. He just rips the guy for like 20 minutes about what a loser he is and how much he's going to regret this and how he's going to make him pay for this. And just, and people think, oh gosh, that's so extreme, that surely that doesn't happen as much. Well, it doesn't have to. Very few coaches have to go to that length because the rules do it for them. The system is set up to control players and their movement and their ability to feel free to advocate for themselves. So I feel like this whole time of year, part of what is uncomfortable, again, this is me talking, is uncomfortable for somebody who spent so many years in this business, is that part of how we used our chess pieces in the game was, how can we move, how can we jockey ourselves in this system to benefit, to get a better situation for ourselves, to find, I mean, one of the things we valued was stability and relationships. How do we use our social capital, our financial capital to get a situation that's good for our family? Players don't have that. They don't have that at all. And this time of year is a time of year when that is so clear. It's right in front of everybody's faces. You've been listening to Going Deep, Sports in the 21st Century, from the studios of Blue Ridge Public Radio, NPR for Western North Carolina. Tell us what you think of the show by emailing us at goingdeep@bpr.org. Make sure to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter @ShoopsGoingDeep.